This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Poet Peter Balakian grew up in suburban New Jersey in the 50s and 60s in a prosperous family of Armenian descent. It wasn't until he was a young man that he learned that some of his relatives had survived what's often described as the Armenian Genocide of 1915. The history of 1915 is highly controversial. The Turkish government denies there was a genocide, but does admit that more than 500,000 Armenians died when they were forced to evacuate their homes in Turkey and march to a camp in Aleppo, Syria. They say the Ottoman government relocated the Armenians because they were siding with invading Russians. Armenians see it as ethnic cleansing of a Christian minority and claim that more than 1 million Armenians were murdered by the Young Turk government or perished during a death march, and another 1 million were exiled. Peter Balakian's new memoir, Black Dog of Fate, is about what it was like to uncover the hidden history of his grandmother who helped raise him. She survived a death march along with her 2 young children, Balakian's aunts. Balakian's father was also an Armenian exile.
I think my first real wrestling with the Armenian Genocide past and its impact on my family came when I wrote a small poem when I was in my early 20s and teaching in a high school and a prep school in Englewood, New Jersey. And it was a strange event because my mother wanted me to attend my grandmother's 10th anniversary, the 10th anniversary commemoration of her death. Hoki Hankist is the Armenian word. And I was too busy to do that. I had a weekend planned with my girlfriend up in Cambridge, Mass, and I said, no, I'm off, and I'm going to do my own thing. And I came back after that weekend feeling a kind of remorse and guilt when I returned home. I hadn't felt any all weekend. And I sat down and I wrote a poem called Words for My Grandmother. And it was a very, it was a strange experience because I did not set out to write a poem about anything, but was sort of led, I should say, about anything political or historical. I was simply led by images of my childhood with my grandmother. And that poem ended up being the first real shovel in the dig, in the excavation, if you will, into the Armenian past, into the genocide past.
I think one of the real pivotal parts in learning about your family's past and the Armenian genocide was getting your Aunt Gladys to talk. And she had been a baby, I guess, during the death march that she, her sister, and your grandmother survived. How did you get her talking about the past?
Well, that was an interesting story because, you know, there was no open conversation about the Armenian genocide in my family when I was growing up. And the things that were passed on to me, I believe, were passed on in encoded and symbolic ways, complex ways, ways that I'd come to put together, you know, after I understood more literally the history. And my Aunt Gladys, who was a 2-year-old on the death march and survived and then lived in the Armenian genocide refugee quarter in Aleppo as a young girl, never talked until one day when we were in Paris together. This was 1977. I was already in graduate school. I went on a small trip with my aunts to Europe. And I think it had something to do with being in France and something to do with being, I don't know, somehow maybe back in Europe and around our French cousins and French relatives. But one morning on our fourth or fifth day in Paris, we were in a hotel and she saw I was reading a book about LBJ. And she said, you know, she said to me, you know, I think LBJ had something to do with Kennedy being killed. And I said, oh, that's an incredible idea. And she said, well, that's the way they do it. She said, that's the way crimes happen. And I my eyes opened up because I'd never heard my aunt talking like this. And she went on to say to me, well, look what they did to Armenia. Look what happened to Armenia. And at that moment, the whole door opened. And I said, well, what do you mean, Auntie Gladys? Tell me, you've never talked to me about what happened to Granny, what happened to you, the death march, and so forth. And And she began to talk, and she began to tell me the story that she remembered, the fragments and images she remembered.
Can you share some of that story with us?
Well, among the things she conveyed to me that day in a hotel room in Paris were the first images she had of being in Aleppo, and the image of her father dead in a coffin, because my grandmother's first husband died on the death march. And the images she conveyed to me were so spare. They were poetical in the sense they were just rinsed down and austere. She remembered something about the refugee quarter in Aleppo. She remembered her mother, my grandmother, in a hospital, dying, being told by the German nurses that her mother would be dead the next day, that she had contracted cholera and could not survive the night. And she remembered being led out of the hospital. And she remembered that 2 days later, my grandmother walked through the door, alive and chipper, actually. And then she remembered the passage that they took from the Middle East to Marseille. And she remembered the excitement of being on that steamship. And there were only women, Armenian women and children on this steamer, because all the men had been killed, and most of the survivors were women and children. And she remembered something of the strangeness and the excitement of that sense of going somewhere, of somehow some kind of liberation. And then she told me that extraordinary story about sleeping in the churches along the harbor in Marseille, because of course there were no places for the refugees to sleep, and at night she noticed that none of the mothers went to sleep, and she asked her mother, "Why aren't you going to sleep at night, Mama?" And her mother answered, "If we go to sleep, the ceiling will open and dead bodies will fall in on us."
And I have to say, incredible image.
Extraordinary image. And I have to say that when I heard that image, I knew that this was something for poetry. I mean, that it was bigger than poetry, but it was something that was so rich symbolically and literally, and it blew me away.
This is actually, that line shows up in one of your poems, which I hope you'll be able to read for us later in the program. One of the things that your aunt did when you were having this long conversation with her is that she showed you a copy of your grandmother's suit against Turkey, a lawsuit against Turkey, suing for damages and suing for all the possessions that were her family's that were, you know, confiscated by the Turks. You reprint an excerpt of that document in your new memoir, and I'm hoping that you can read some of that for us now.
Yes, I'd love to. It wasn't for another few years that my aunts allowed me to see that document. I don't know why, but things were unveiled to me slowly. And the document is extraordinary because here this woman who has lost everything, everybody in her family, her husband, all her possessions, her house, her nation, comes to Aleppo as a survivor, and she begins.
This is Aleppo, a refugee camp in Syria.
Yes, that's right. In the city, in the quarter, in one of the old quarters of Aleppo, the Armenians who did survive, you know, took refuge there for a while. So she begins filing. She begins compiling. All the complex legal layers for this human rights suit then, around circa 1916, and she files the suit officially in the United States in 1920 in Newark, New Jersey, shortly after her arrival in the United States. And I would like to read from question 63 of this suit, which is a claim against foreign governments, it's called, and because her husband was a naturalized U.S. citizen, she felt she had an extra right to make this claim in the United States. It was a State Department official document. She writes in the answer to answer this question, state in detail the facts or circumstances attending the losses or injuries enumerated in answer 55. My grandmother records, after 3 days' journey, they killed one by one the man deportees, of whom only a few were saved. So were killed mercilessly my brothers and sisters and other relatives mentioned in the answer 55. My husband, in spite of that he was a citizen of USA, was forced to be deported with us, his naturalization paper and passport being taken of him by the gendarmes. As he was feeble and indisposed, being subjected to such conditions and seeing our relatives killed unhumanly, he could not support the life and died, leaving me, a widow, with my two orphan daughters, named Zivart, 7 years old, and Arshalouis, 5 years old. They became Gladys and Alice, by the way. We, the remaining of the deportees, women and children, were forced to walk without being allowed even to buy some bread to eat. Frequently we were robbed by Turks and the gendarmes, as if they would carry us safely to our destiny, which was entirely unknown to us. So for 32 days we were obliged to wander through mountains and valleys. Fatigue and hunger enforced by the whip of the cruel gendarmes diminished the number of the deportees. After many dangers, whose descriptions would take much time, a few women and children, included I myself, arrived at Aleppo, Syria, in the beginning of September 1915. Since then, I am supported by the Honorable Consulate of USA in Aleppo, Syria. The deportation itself and the fiendish steps taken against the Armenians in general being well known by the civilized world, I do not mention other evidence concerning this matter. Only, I assert that, one, the Turkish government is responsible for the losses and injuries happened to, because I am a human being. I am under the support of human and international law.
Whatever became of the suit? Did she get anything that she was suing for? Did she get any response from the Turkish government at all?
As far as we know, nothing became of this. She filed it in the law offices of Joseph J. Derna, in Newark, New Jersey, and we know nothing else except that it sat in a dresser drawer in my aunt's study for 60 years, and she never spoke about it with anyone. And near the end of the book, I speculate on how much horror and pain must have followed the making of this suit and the finding that it couldn't be listened to in 1920, as I think it can be listened to in 1997.
Why do you think it couldn't be listened to in 1920? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that the whole concept of human rights was a new one, and in 1920, that the international notions of human rights were just evolving, and that the Armenian Genocide, being the century's first genocide, being a kind of watershed event for modernity, had to wait a while before more history of the 20th century caught up with it. And, you know, I think after the Holocaust, I think after the Cambodian Genocide, we've come to understand a lot more about genocide and human rights, and of course the United Nations proclamation about the meaning of genocide didn't happen until 1948, so that I feel in some sense my grandmother was way ahead of her time, realizing that she could make a human rights claim for the Armenian Genocide.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Balakian, and he's written a new memoir called Black Dog of Fate, An American Son Uncovers His Armenian Past. Peter, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Balakian, author of a memoir called Black Dog of Fate, An American Son Uncovers His Armenian Past. When you were young, you knew that there was something different about your grandmother, and you thought that what was different was that she was from the old country and she cooked different foods and she spoke a different language and told different kinds of stories, but you knew nothing about the genocide. You knew nothing of how she survived. You must have been shocked when you found out what it was that really set her apart.
Well, I was. And at the same time, she was a marvelously colorful, interesting woman and a great friend and my companion in so many ways as a young boy. There were strange little leakages of symbolic tales, folk tales, and an occasional parable, and even once a kind of a flashback that I had experienced from her. And while those were not direct, she certainly never spoke to me directly about the genocide, I suppose my head was already filled with some other kinds of tremors from her imagination. But you're right, I didn't really have any direct historical knowledge of what had happened to her. And so when I did discover it, it put so many things together for me, and it re-solidified my whole relationship with my grandmother. She was the only grandparent I had, so it was an extra special relationship. And to find out that she had undergone this really is something that has changed my life.
Even though your grandmother didn't really talk about the genocide, she had a nervous breakdown after Pearl Harbor. Was there a connection to her between the outbreak of war and what she had survived?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, it seemed like perhaps a classic situation of a kind of post-traumatic stress experience. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, my grandmother had a breakdown, and it was the first time since the genocide, since her death march experience, that she began to talk now about the Turkish experience, about the Turks coming. She kept saying, "The Turks are coming. It doesn't matter," she kept saying to her daughters. "It doesn't matter what you do. We're all going to be dead tomorrow. We're all going to be dead tomorrow." And she collapsed entirely. She was obsessed and paranoid and had flashbacks and so on. And my Aunt Gladys was able to secure for her electroshock therapy treatment, and it worked. And she came out of that and again went back into a complete numbing. She never talked openly about the genocide experience after that. But it's so interesting that that catastrophe of the U.S. entry into World War II did prompt this post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Peter, you grew up not knowing about the Armenian genocide and about your family that perished and the members of your family that survived. How much did your parents know about it?
Well, I think that my father was the most interested and had the most knowledge about the genocide. And I think my mother, had less historical knowledge of the details of history, although she knew very well the trauma that her mother's life had involved, because her mother was a death march survivor. So I think both of them, had different kinds of relationships to the genocide, and both of them found it very difficult to talk openly to any of us about that. There are a few moments, I recount these in the book, where my father brings me to the water. He wants me to understand something happened of huge importance in 1915 to our people. And yet, each one of those situations results in a kind of broken circuit. We can't quite come to talk about them.
What's an example of what you mean?
Well, there's a almost bizarrely comic moment when I'm in eighth grade, and I'm assigned a term paper to do on a Middle Eastern culture. And my father gets very excited, and he says, "This is marvelous." He says, this is a real moment for you to understand something about Armenia." So I go to do my dutiful research, and I go into the encyclopedias, and I go into some reference books in the library, and I can't find anything about Armenia. There's so little in there, and there's nothing about any tragedies. It's just little kind of entries. And so I say to myself, well, if I can't find about Armenia, I know that Armenians once lived in Turkey, so why don't I go and write about Turkey? So I go and I write, and time is running out now, and I have to get this term paper done. So I, you know, I work hard as I can against the deadline. I write this term paper about Turkey, and I bring it home, and I've gotten an A on the paper, and my father looks at it, and he's just devastated. And he says to me, "Why have you done this? Why have you written about Turkey? Don't you know what the Turks did to the Armenians?" And I say, "Well, sure, yeah, sure, I know." And it's a humiliating moment. And I run, I leave the table. And he says nothing to me after that. And we just leave it there, a kind of broken dialogue. And there are a couple of episodes like that in which my father wants me to know, and then he can't quite bring himself to tell me. I was 13 at the time in that particular episode.
Peter Balakian's new memoir is called Black Dog of Fate. An American Son uncovers his Armenian past. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Peter Balakian, author of Black Dog of Fate. An American Son uncovers his Armenian past. It's about how he learned members of his family survived what Armenians call the Armenian Genocide of 1915. The history of 1915 is very controversial. The Turkish government denies there was a genocide, but does say that more than 500,000 Armenians died when they were forced to evacuate their homes in Turkey and march to a camp in Aleppo, Syria. Balakian's grandmother and aunts survived that march. You write in your memoir that the journey into the Armenian genocide was for you inseparable from poetry. Poetry was part of the journey of the excavation. I'd like you to read one of the poems that you've written about the genocide.
Well, I'd be happy to. I've reprinted two of my poems in the memoir. And I'd like to read from a poem called The History of Armenia, which I wrote almost immediately after talking with my aunt Gladys that day in Paris in 1977. And it was a poem that really changed my sense of what poetry could be. It changed the direction of my writing. It goes like this. Last night, my grandmother returned in the brown dress, standing on Oriton Parkway, where we used to walk and watch the highway being dug out. She stood against a backdrop of steam hammers and bulldozers, a bag of fruit in her hand, the wind blowing through her eyes. I was running toward her in a drizzle with the morning paper. When I told her I was hungry, she said, "In the grocery store, a man is standing to his ankles in blood. The babies in East Orange have disappeared, maybe eaten by the machinery on this long road." When I asked for my mother, she said, "Gone, all gone. The girls went for soda. Maybe the Coke was bad. The candy sour. This morning, the beds are empty, water off, the toilets dry. When I went to the garden for squash, only stump was there. When I went to clip parsley, only a hole." We walked past piles of gray cinder and cement trucks. There were no men. She said, "Grandpa left in the morning, in the dark. He had pants to press for the firemen of East Orange. They called him in the middle of night. West Orange was burning. Montclair was burning. Bloomfield and Newark were gone. One woman carried the arms of her child to West Orange last night and fell on her uncle's stoop. Two boys came with the skin of their legs in their pockets and turned themselves in to local officials. This morning's sun is red and spreading. If I go to sleep tonight," she said, "the ceiling will open and bodies will fall from clouds. Yavri, where is the angel without six fingers and a missing leg? Where is the angel with the news that the river is coming back? The angel with the word that the water will be clear and have fish?" Grandpa is pressing pants. They came for him before the birds were up. He left without shoes or tie, without shirt or suspenders. It was quiet. The birds were still sleeping.
Is this your poem imagining if there were a genocide in New Jersey when you were growing up?
Well, it is a poem. You know, you're absolutely right. It is a poem that is set in the New Jersey of East Orange and Newark, where my grandmother lived and where I used to go and visit her, particularly in East Orange on Oraton Parkway, where the Garden State Parkway was being built in the late 50s. And what I wanted to do in this poem was to really bring the past into the present, to fuse and blend the genocidal past with the New Jersey present, and to do what Faulkner, you know, as Faulkner said, bring the presentness of the past alive, because the past isn't over, it isn't even past. And I suppose in that way the poem also wants to really explore trauma and the ongoing afterlife and aftermath of traumatic horror of the kind that my grandmother lived through.
You know, your book is in part about growing up in a very prosperous suburb in New Jersey during the time of the real, like, American suburban dream.
Right.
And then finding out about what your real past was and the vast kind of gulf between the suburban optimism and the genocide your family or members of your family survived. Does that seem still pretty irreconcilable to you? Do you know that?
Well, I think it's, I don't know if it's irreconcilable, but I think it's an interesting and complex tension. And I think these kinds of interesting and complex tensions are so much of what make the United States such a vibrant and interesting culture. Because I know that Armenian Americans are one of many peoples in this culture who live in those odd collisions of dark pasts and trauma and bright presence and happy affluence. So I think that when I understood the Armenian genocide past, I came to see our life in suburbia as affluent, upwardly mobile, upper middle class Americans as more interesting and richer. I mean, we weren't just there to climb the ladder of success. We were there because this was a moment of rare and beautiful security in some way for peoples who have endured such extremity and pain and had made such a long journey out of the hellishness of the genocide to this new world where life really had so much to offer. And I think it made my sense of the American, the brightness of the American dream, a richer one.
Peter Balakian, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Peter Balakian's new memoir is called Black Dog of Fate.